shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Tonight I want to talk about a subject that somebody needs to talk about and the regular churches don't. Our churches in general have made our religion a thing of complete confusion. They don't understand it themselves, and they can't teach their people about it. And that is why every time you find a debate held between a really intelligent atheist and some clergyman, the atheist makes a monkey out of him, because the atheist knows more about the Bible than he does, and the clergyman doesn't know where to look for the answers. If he really had some faith in the book that he purports to uphold, he'd have no trouble disposing of the atheist. Our churches have tried to whittle our religion down to one thing only. They've limited it to, first of all, the individual, not the nation. And as to the individual, they've limited it to one thing, and that is his salvation in a future life. In spite of the fact that at least a good 5/6 of the Bible deals with the nation, and no individual by himself could for them. These preachers base this, of course, upon one thing that Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 2, where he said this, "For I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified." So these preachers really carry that out. Their ignorance is total and absolute upon all subjects save that one. And no man who purports to speak the word of God is entitled to stand upon the platform if he doesn't know the rest of it. If he even read 1 Corinthians, he'd know better. The first chapter of it shows why Paul said what he did. He says that the Corinthians knew these other things very well, but they were gripping into fact. Instead of realizing that this was the word of God, they were paying too much attention to the particular leaders who had taught them. And one said, "Well, I'm a follower of Paul." And another said, "I'm a follower of somebody else," and so forth. And they were scrapping over which of the leaders was the greatest, instead of realizing that none of their leaders were anything but spokesmen for the word of God. So he said, "Among you, I'm not spending time on these other things. I've got to get you back on the first track. You've got to understand now what all this has led up to. That the fulfillment of everything in the Old Testament, which you know perfectly well, has actually come with the work that Jesus Christ has accomplished." In that same thing, 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 6, he goes on to say, "Howbeit, we speak wisdom among those that are mature, but your average minister of today can't speak wisdom because he doesn't have it. He isn't mature himself mentally." Even for the individual, if these clergymen only would learn their book, they would realize that the laws of God are not abolished. They're for the individual. Christ himself said, this is Matthew 5, verses 17 and 18, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law of the prophets. I came not to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled." When do heaven and earth pass away? You find that in Revelation 21, verse 1. It is after the return of Christ, after his thousand-year reign here on earth of the millennium, after the second resurrection for judgment, the wicked are disposed of, then for the first time it says the old heaven and earth had passed away, and I saw a new heaven and earth. Now even the individual couldn't receive salvation till he repented of his sins. And for the nation, there cannot be success until the nation turns back to the laws of God. The purpose of the law was never your salvation in another life. The purpose of the law was that you might live the best possible life here in this world. that you might have the best things which life in this world can provide. Take the dietary laws, for example. They are concerned with your not eating unwholesome food here and now. Likewise, the financial laws. You're not going to have to borrow from the Jews in heaven. They never suspected that you were. But it was to keep you from getting into the clutches of Jewish usurers in this world that the financial laws were given. The law is a thing for here and now, not hereafter. Nearly all of the Bible is directed to the nation, not the individual, fully five-sixths. It is something that while it is the individual's duty to obey, the results of it cannot be had. If a scattered individual here and there are the only ones who obey it, it can be put into effect only nationally. Its laws, for example, cover government and administration, trial of lawsuits, standards of weights and measures, the agricultural laws, the dietary laws, care of the poor and needy, laws of warfare, the financial laws. All these things are for the nation. And likewise, it is true of all of these. The laws of God are natural laws, just as much so as the law of gravity. You cannot violate. They state something in the alternative. Do this, and you get good results. Fail to do it, and you get bad results. Now you have your choice. You can do one or the other, but you're going to get the results that you were told about, good or bad as the case may be. You don't violate the law of gravity if you jump out a 10-story window. You obey it the hard way and pay the penalty. If you ride down in the elevator, you obey it the easy way and you get the benefit. And so with all of these. And that is a part of both national and individual destiny. And when we try to outwit destiny, to outwit God, we aren't going to get it. This scheme of laws for the nation was given, and it is the part of the book that has an it. Now, so far as our final destiny to accomplish certain parts of God's will is concerned, that he stated definitely would happen, and there was no if about it. Then he told us, if you follow my law, you'll get there the easy way. If you don't, you'll still have to do what I say, but it'll be rough. Now take, for example, in the 28th chapter of Deuteronomy, where Moses was telling them this, and it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to observe and do all his commandments, which I command thee this day, that Yahweh thy God will set thee on high above all nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come on thee and overtake thee. Blessed shalt thou be in the city, and blessed shalt thou be in the field. Yahweh shall cause thine enemies that rise up against thee to be smitten before thy face. They shall come out against thee one way, and flee before thee seven ways. Yahweh shall command the blessing upon thee in thy storehouses, and in all that thou settest thine hand to. Yahweh shall establish thee a holy people unto himself, as he hath sworn to thee, if thou shalt keep the commandments of Yahweh thy God, and walk in his ways. And all people of the earth shall see that thou art called by the name of Yahweh, and they shall be afraid of thee. And Yahweh shall make thee the head, and not the tail, and thou shalt be above only, and thou shalt not be beneath. So, note the if. You get the benefits if you obey. And he goes on, for example, in Leviticus, the 26th chapter. If ye walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. And I will give peace in the land, and ye shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. And I will rid evil beasts out of the land. Some of you remember, perhaps, when I talked to you here about what the Bible called beasts, and you noticed that some of them had 2 feet only instead of 4, and even behaved in some respects like human beings. And we're having trouble with them right now when they're conducting what they call demonstrations. God said he would rid these evil beasts out of the land. Neither shall the sword go through your land. And ye shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you with the sword. And 5 of you shall chase 100. And 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight. And your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. Now that's the easy way. Victory in war that shatters your enemies and without any heavy penalty of casualties to you. But note this though. Here's one that doesn't have any if. This is Jeremiah 51 verse 20. Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war. For with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms. Now that's not an invitation or an offer. That's a command. God said, these pagan nations that try to wrongly rule the earth, I'm going to shatter and destroy, and you're going to do it. You're my battle axe and weapons of war. Now you can do it the easy way, with little cost and few casualties. Or you can do it the bitter way, with thousands of your sons dead in the mud on the battlefield. But you're going to do it. There isn't any if about that. That's an absolute command. Which way do we choose to go? You know. You know what it's cost. For rebellion against God, there is a penalty. That's a destiny that our smartest politicians can't outwit. You can't fool God. He runs the show. He knows in advance what kind of a person you are and what you're likely to do. And he tells you, better do it this way, because if you don't, I've told you what will happen. We've had the warning. For example, in 2 Chronicles 15, verse 2, Yahweh is with you while ye be with him. And if ye seek him, he will be found by you. But if ye forsake him, he will forsake you. Do you think it's of no importance that we're taking the Bible out of our schools? That we're letting the Supreme Court substitute, you might say, compulsory atheism? Every time we've gone through that, our ancestors have gone through this repeatedly, and every time it led to disaster. It isn't as though this was something new where we might theorize about the results. It's happened with monotonous frequency. You know the saying, history repeats itself. One philosopher said, yes, the reason is that those who will not learn the lessons of history are compelled to relive them. That's what we've had to go through. In Jeremiah 22, verses 3 to 5, God tried to reason with us. And he found so few capable of reason. Thus saith Yahweh, execute judgment and righteousness, and deliver the spoiled out of the hands of the oppressor. And do no wrong, no violence to the stranger, the fatherless, nor the widow, neither shed innocent blood in this place. For if ye do this thing indeed, then shall there enter in by the gates of this house kings sitting upon the throne of David, riding in chariots and upon horses, he and his servants and his people. But if ye will not hear these words, I swear by myself, saith Yahweh, that this house shall become a desolation. One thing that we are living out today in every detail, you find in the 28th chapter of Deuteronomy, verses 15 to 45. But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Remember, I read you the earlier part of it, where he said, if you do follow his laws, these blessings shall come. Now here's the other side of the coin. If you will not, all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. There's more listed here, but note these among the significant ones. Thy heaven that is over thy head shall be brass, and the earth that is under thee shall be iron. And Yahweh shall make the rain of thy land powder and dust. You remember the dust storms of the 1930s back in the Dust Bowl? One of these laws of God, one of the agricultural laws, is this. for six consecutive years you may plow the land and sow your crops. In the seventh year you must let it lie fallow. An interesting thing came. Now they had not mere legends, they had accurate records of just how many bushels of wheat per acre they got out of that land. Then came the Dust Bowl period, and they had to let the land lie fallow for, I think, 3 or 4 years. Otherwise, the whole state would have blown away. But the time came when, after letting the land rest, they again plowed it up and sowed it to crops. And they noticed a startling thing. The same fields on which they had their records, the yield of so many bushels to the acre, they got up to 400%. Four times the yield per acre they'd gotten off that same field before. They could have followed God's law the easy way and gotten the profit. They followed it the hard way and paid the penalty. Though even then, when as a penalty they had to let it lie fallow, still, when they obeyed it then, however unwillingly, the next crop, they got the benefit. But they haven't learned even now. Thou shalt be oppressed and spoiled evermore, and no man shall save thee. Hasn't our government become one of ever-increasing oppression? Oppressed and spoiled, you bet. Our plundered taxpayers are facing a degree of ruthless rapacity that was not even visited upon the conquerors by the evil empires of the past. We're plundered and spoiled. No man saves us. We turn from one lying, cheating politician to another lying, cheating politician, and each one is as bad as the one before. That's right. That's one of the curses that was listed, and it's coming. The fruit of thy land and all thy labors shall a nation which thou knowest not eat up. Thou shalt become a proverb and a byword among all nations, whither Yahweh shall lead thee. Aren't we? Aren't we despised everywhere in the world because we have made ourselves despicable? The stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. Actually, the mere figurehead puppet isn't running the country at all. He takes his orders from a Russian-born Jew. He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail. Can you sum it all up in fewer words than that? God knew what he was talking about. Now, if we'd obeyed God, we needn't have had all these troubles, the wars and so forth that we've been through. In Isaiah, the 48th chapter, hear ye this, O house of Jacob, which are called by the name of Israel, and are come forth out of the waters of Judah, which swear by the name of Yahweh, and make mention of the God of Israel, but not in truth, nor in righteousness. Thus saith Yahweh thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, I am Yahweh thy God, which teacheth thee to profit, which leadeth thee by the way that thou shouldst go. Oh, that thou hadst hearkened to my commandments, then had thy peace been as a river, and thy righteousness as the waves of the sea. We couldn't have had it. If we hadn't been stupid, stubborn, and unfortunately, cowardly. We didn't have the brains to follow it, and we didn't have the courage to follow it. When actually, it was the easier way, if we had only seen. Again, in the 32nd chapter of Isaiah, and the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. And my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation, and in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. Well, you know we have. And you know why? Evil Jews have become the complete masters of our government. For a while, under Roosevelt and Truman and Eisenhower, they were secretly the masters. And they got away with it. So now they don't have to pretend anymore. They're openly the masters. 85% of the alleged advisors from whom our president takes his orders are Jews. Those are the ones that appear openly in the picture. The answers are in the book, of course. It was all foreseen. In Proverbs 25, verse 5, take away the wicked from before the king, and his throne shall be established in righteousness. Take away the Jews, and even he might do a right thing once in a while. Let's turn to Jeremiah this time. Jeremiah 5, verses 26 to 31. For among my people are found wicked men. Now, the Bible uses language with great precision when it's translated accurately. He doesn't say, my people are these wicked men, but he says, among them you find these wicked people. Not his people, but found among them. Shall not I visit for these things, saith Yahweh? Shall not my soul be avenged on such a nation as this? A wonderful and horrible thing is committed in the land. The prophets prophesy falsely, and the priests bear rule by their means. And my people love to have it. And what will he do in the end? You know, today, by current usage, we consider prophecy to be a foretelling of the future, and a prophet, therefore, one who foretells the future. But that was not the original meaning of the word used in the Bible. The prophet was one who spoke by divine inspiration and gave the word of God, and he was primarily a teacher. As part of that, he had occasionally to say, these things are going to happen to you if you don't behave. And he did from time to time predict the future, but that was not the primary part of it. So, the prophets or teachers teach falsely, and the priests bear rule by their means, yes. Actually, don't you see that today? What are your poor brainwashed kids in school these days? You know what? They're making socialist robots out of them. And what do you get from the churches? Do you get any opposition to this evil thing? No. The churches go right along with it because they've become as satanic as any other part of it. How many people will wake up? They'd rather that you didn't bring up the unpleasant subject. My people love to have it so. But what would you do in the end thereof? You see, we forget that evil consists not merely of evil acts. We say, oh, well, God will forgive us. We just say our prayers and believe in Jesus Christ, and he pardons the particular evil acts we've done. That's only part of it. That's the least of it. The trouble is that evil acts create evil conditions. And these evil conditions are going to be here till you do something to remedy them. What will you do in the end thereof? Every time, by your action or by your acquiescence, you set up these evil conditions. Sooner or later, you're going to have to right the wrong that you've done. Like any other burdensome debt, it carries a terrible rate of interest. And the longer you delay, the harder it is to pay that. That's what we're having to go through. And it was all in the book. It's been there all these thousands of years. But what church can you go into and have your minister preach that to? Does anybody think that this was merely written for ancient times? Let's turn to Isaiah 30, verses 8 to 10. Now go, write it before them in the book, that it may be for the time to come, forever and ever, that this is a rebellious people. Lying children, children that will not hear the law of Yahweh, which say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not and do it rightly. Speak unto a smooth thing, prophesy deceit. Isn't that true? If I wanted to give one of these soothing syrup talks about how this is the best of all possible worlds, all you need to do is mix up and mongrelize and have everybody a half animal. Well, you know, I could have 100 times as many people come into it and laugh. They don't want the truth. They can do a smooth thing, prophesy to see. But they're going to have to pay for it. They're creating the condition that you are seeing as a boil coming to a head. Listen to Amos. Amos 5, verses 10 to 13. They hate him that rebuketh in the gate, and they abhor him that speaketh uprightly. For as much, therefore, as your treading is upon the poor, and ye take from him burdens of wheat, ye have built houses of hewn stone, but ye shall not dwell in them. Ye have planted pleasant vineyards, but ye shall not drink wine from them. For I know your manifold sins. They afflict the just. They take a bribe, and they turn aside the poor in the gate from their right. Therefore, the prudent shall keep silent in that time, for it is an evil time. Don't they? Don't you know a lot of people that actually know the things you found out here, but they don't dare say so? Sure, it costs you plenty. The prudent shall keep silent in those days, for it shall be an evil time. And it is. You have the Jews carrying out the satanic plan. You know, every once in a while somebody says to me, but Mr. Pomeray, don't you think, though, that the converted Jews are all right? Well, might be they could be converted into fertilizer and be some good that. When you get home, you open your Bible to the 8th chapter of the Gospel of John. And beginning at verse 31, you read on through verse 44. That's where Christ identifies the Jews as the children of their father, the devil. Now, it starts right out with identifying what kind of Jews these are in John 8:31. What do you mean by a converted Jew? You mean a Jew that believes in Jesus Christ, don't you? It says that these were Jews who believed in him. Peculiar Jews, weren't they? These were converted Jews. And they are the ones that he winds up in that same conversation, finally saying, ye are the children of your father, the devil, and the evil deeds of your father, ye will do. That's the converted ones. And the others, you may be sure, know best. So if anybody tells you, well, but the converted Jews will be all right, you tell him, go brush the dust off the Bible and open it and read it. And see what Jesus Christ says. And if that man claims to be a Christian, but says, oh, well, Christ was just lying about these poor persecuted people, then you know what kind of a Christian he is. Christ identified. We've seen now that God said we could have good things if we would obey this law. We were going to have trouble if we didn't. Well, what sort of things then ought we to be doing? Now, as I said before, it's not a matter of trying to get your individual, personal salvation by obeying the law. That was never its object. One part of the law, and the dietary law, says that you shall not eat the flesh of an animal that has died of disease. All right. You find out in the field the carcass of a cow that has died of hoof and mouth disease, and you cut off the steaks and cook it and eat it. No, you're not going to lose your salvation in the next world, but you're immediately going to lose your health in this one. And that's all that law ever had anything to do with. Well, let's briefly take a look at some of these. It's too big a subject to try to cover exhaustively in one evening, but let's hit some high spots. First, the agricultural law. Leviticus 25, verses 1 to 22, gives you this rule about the year of rest for the land every 7th year. Now, I mentioned to you the fact that one of the consequences of violating that can be the dust bowl conditions. But there's another one. You know how much scientific and semi-scientific literature there's been out in the past few years showing what they have discovered about the fact that our food needs to be supplemented. The trouble is that we have worn out our soil, and you cannot take out of the soil what is no longer in it. Sure, you can get ammonium nitrate and put on it, and the unhealthy plants that grow will turn green. But do you know why you're supposed to be taking those mineral supplements? Because they're not in the soil. Now, basically, the sand of the soil is pure now, but it's insoluble. And what will not dissolve in water cannot be taken up out of the soil of the plants. There live among the grains of sand in the soil countless trillions of bacteria. And as a part of their existence, a byproduct of their existence, they produce certain acids which corrode away the surface of these sand grains and break them down into compounds which will dissolve in water. Then the plants pick these up and the necessary minerals are taken into the plant. You eat the plants directly in some cases. In other cases, your cattle eat them and the mineral goes into the meat. Whether you're vegetarian or meat eater, whatever you get has to come out of the soil. For thousands of years, we've bred our plants for heavy yield, which means drawing heavily on the soil. Now what happens is this. Your plants draw out of the soil each year more soluble minerals than these bacteria can replace. Now you started with quite a supply of it. It's like spending more than your income each year, and eventually you exhaust your savings. And from then on, you can't get any more than your income, and the income isn't sufficient. Now, in 6 years, you have drawn down the supply of available minerals, that is, the soluble minerals, to the point where there isn't enough. If you will let the thing alone, plant them, give the soil a year's rest undisturbed, the bacteria will produce a full year's worth of providing soluble minerals. Then the next year you plant. And in addition to that year's production of minerals, you've got your backlog, your savings account of a year's production to draw on. And so on. So by 6 years, you've used up your surplus. That's the real reasoning back of this. Now, God doesn't bother arguing things with you. He tells you the result. If you're curious enough, you can look into it and find out why. You know the article about what they call the hidden hunger? Sure, you can eat till your stomach groans, and you don't get enough. All right, listen to this. This is Micah 6, verses 13 and 14. Thou shalt eat, but not be satisfied. And it goes on to explain that this is as a punishment for violating God's law. Another thing you'll find just in Leviticus 19, verses 23 to 25. It says that when you plant fruit trees, for the first 3 years, nothing can be eaten from that tree. As a matter of fact, you're not supposed to allow fruit to form once for 3 years. You go around and nip off those buds. Now the fourth year, the fruit that is produced then, you cannot have. You may bring it to the temple as a gift, but you can't have that for yourself. Even the fourth year, you can't be greedy. Now the fifth year and thereafter, you may have the fruit from that tree. See, this is starting from the time you first plant that tree. I don't mean that this is every 5 years. This is once in the beginning of the tree. I had a chance to see that actually put into practice. A friend of mine and his next door neighbor cleared the brush off the same side of the same hillside out near Escondido, the same year. They planted it to orange trees, and they were the same size trees the same year. Nothing but a barbed wire fence between my friend's orchard and his neighbor. The same kind of soil, the same exposure to sunlight, the same everything, the trees planted the same year. And I got a look at that when the fifth year's crop was forming on the trees. Now the neighbor's trees didn't look like much. Their branches were thin and spindly, and they had a mediocre crop on them, and there was a wooden board prop under every branch so it wouldn't break under the weight of just a few arms. My friend had followed this law. This was the first time that oranges had been permitted to form on that tree. His trees looked double the age of the others. Thick branches. He had more than twice the crop that his neighbor had. There wasn't a crop under any of these branches, and there wasn't a one in danger of breaking under the weight of double the crop. The neighbor had tried to coax every orange he could off these trees from the time they were as big as weeds. All their strength had gone into producing a few oranges instead of producing good sound wood that would hold the crop. Now, when you told us the fifth year,
My friend would have had more oranges for 5 years than his neighbor. He'd already made a profit by obeying God's law, and from then on it would cure them. These laws work. They're natural laws. They're not just theories. You know, the one that made all these things was the one who gave us the law, and he knew what he was talking about. Another thing you'll find in Leviticus 23, verse 22, it says you must not reap your field clear to the edges and corners. Now that sounds funny, doesn't it? Why, if you reaped every bit, sure, you'd have a few grains of wheat here and there, you could probably fill a bushel basket with what you're passing up. Oh, we are more modern. Instead of the old-fashioned zigzag rail fence, we have our barbed wire fence, and we even come up and reap underneath where the barb is projected, so we won't miss anything. And then we spend hundreds of million dollars a year for poison to keep down the insect, and the insect is still getting ahead of us. And if you left those fence corners, there would be the cover where the birds would nest and breed, and the birds would take care of the insects, and they wouldn't charge you a penny for it. Sure. God knew what he was talking about. He made all this. Of course he can write the instruction book on it. Well, let's take the dietary laws for another sample. In Leviticus 7, verses 23 to 25, it says you must not eat animal fat. Don't eat the fat of the meat. Wasteful. You paid the butcher shop so much a pound for this and a quarter of it is fat? No. He's trying to save your life. You know, the last few years we've discovered that animal fat is the worst source of cholesterol of anything we eat. And cholesterol is that substance that accumulates in the lining of your arteries, you know, and gives you hardening of the arteries, which finally results in apoplexy or heart failure or some of those things. Leviticus 7, verses 26 and 27 tells you also that you must not eat the blood. The animals that you kill for food must be drained of the blood. We know why now. We know that a good many virus diseases are transmitted by blood. You eat the blood and you get that. You drain the carcass properly and you will escape it. These rules had reason back. Another rule, as you know, was that you must not eat pork. Well, we know now, of course, that pork is the source of infection with an always terrible and often fatal disease, trichinosis. One of the hardest to diagnose, you see, it consists of tiny little worms that are in the flesh of the pig. And when you eat him, your digestive fluid eat away the little covering around this worm and root. So then he gnaws his way through the lining of your digestive system into the blood vessels, and he drifts around until finally he bores his way out through the side of an artery or vein someplace and takes up his lodging there. And it may happen to be in your heart, and you think you've got bad heart trouble, you have. But it's been tricking up. And it may be in the liver, and you don't realize it doesn't come out until the coroner performs an autopsy on you after death why you have the liver. But there's more than that. A friend of mine has done a great deal of research on cancer. Among the doctors that he worked with, his name escapes me at the moment, he's quite a famous physician and scientist from McGill University in Kansas, Dr. Gruner of McGill University. Dr. Gruner has worked out a blood test for cancer. All he needs to have is a microscope slide smear of your blood. He need never have seen you at all. If you do not have cancer, or that is, if the slide does not show the cancer reaction, he can tell you you don't have it. But two things may make it give the typical cancer reaction. One is that you do in fact have cancer. The other is if you have eaten an ordinary serving of pork and you let that an hour or two times versus a chance and get into the blood, your blood will give the typical cancer yet. Now, we don't know enough about cancer yet to come out and say definitely pork causes cancer. But when it causes that close to it, and we know that to an absolute certainty, it might very well be. Well, now let's take the financial moment for a little here. Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 and 20, lays down a definite rule. To your fellow Israelites, you may not charge any interest on a loan. A loan of money, a loan of property, a loan of anything else, no interest. To the aliens among you, you're under no obligation to lend to them anyway. But if you do, there is no reason why they should use your money with no return at all, and you may make them pay for the privilege. But among your brothers, no interest. We always get too greedy to follow God's law. We get too greedy to let the land rest 1 year out of seven, although that 8 years crop could be as high as four times the normal crop. We're too greedy to obey the law about interest. Statisticians have computed that the increase in the total wealth of the United States, all that everybody owns, everything that can be valued in terms of money, from 1776 down to date, it has increased at a rate equal to 5% compound interest. In other words, at the end of 1776, you paid your living expenses, you paid your debt, and you had $100 saved. At the end of 1777, you'd be worth $105. At the end of 1778, after all your living expenses and debts were paid, you'd have savings of $110.25, and so on. That's the rate at which the total of everybody's wealth accumulates. I think it's safe to say that businesses which are operated at least partly on borrowed capital are probably, on the average, no more successful than the average of businesses generally. Well, now, if you want to borrow money just for gambling on the stock market, and you can make the bank really believe that that's all you're going to do with it, you can borrow for as little as 1% a year for a completely sterile, futile operation in which all you can accomplish is to profit yourself at the cost of somebody else's loss. But if you want money for some useful purpose, can you get it to 5%? You're very lucky if you can get it to 6 or 7. And the poor. Remember how God has spoken at times about the oppression of the poor. When the poor and needy want to borrow, they don't get 1% money. They don't get 6% money. They go the only place they can get it, where they pay 12 to 18 to as high as 40% a year. All right, the total that is produced after paying the cost, including the wages, the total that's produced, what you have left over as profit at the end of the year, all businesses taken together as an average, is 5%. Now, there are some very successful businesses that make more, and there are some that go broke. And the average of them all is just 5%. But remember, the lender has taken all the cream and part of the cream up too. And that's why a great many of these businesses go broke. But the lender is the one who gets rich. Now, does that mean that if you've got some money saved up, the Bible says you can't invest it? No. It says this. You're not investing it, you're following God's law, in the form of a loan on interest. In other words, instead of buying bonds, you'll be buying stock. You will be a part owner in the business, and you will share in its profits. And if God's law were followed, those profits would be greater because they wouldn't be siphoned off by the money lenders as interest. In other words, the Bible recognizes that after you have saved something, you are entitled to have it put to work profitably. But in God's way, not in the Jews' way. Then there's the sabbatic year of release of debt. Every seventh year, the burden of those debts that have proved unpayable is to be canceled. Now, it doesn't mean that you're entitled to borrow with no intention of repaying and wait for the year of release. It doesn't mean that you can borrow with good intentions so you get the money in your hands and then change your mind and say, oh, well, what does it matter? There's no hurry. The year of release is coming through. You have to be honest, then. You have to pay your debt to the extent that you can. But every seventh year, the burden of these unpayable debts is to be canceled. And do you think that's a natural law or not? We won't do it the easy way. God said we'd be prosperous if we did. You know what happens when a depression comes along? The burden of the unpayable debts is wiped out sometimes by formal bankruptcy proceedings in federal courts. Sometimes by just the statute of limitation runs on it, the debt becomes outlawed, to use the common term, but it isn't collected, is it? Every seventh year, let me read to you a list of some of our depressions. 1893, 1900, 1907. The next was due in 1914, and conditions were really terribly bad in 1913. 1921, we got it right on time. 1928, in Europe, it did come then, and we kidded ourselves out of it. It was really here, but we pretended not until 1929. It was due next in 1935, and we did have a Roosevelt depression, lower than the rest of it in 35. It was due again in 1942, but we had the war prosperity, whereby we kidded ourselves that by not only spending all of our own savings, but all of our children's and grandchildren's, we become prosperous. 1949, and we had some. 1956, and we had some. And then the next 7 years, 1962, and you remembered our Kennedy Depression? Every seventh year. Does God know what he's talking about, or doesn't he? Then, there was the Jubilee year. After seven of these sabbatical year things, seven sevens are 49, then the 50th year, the Jubilee year. Those of you who remember the history you learned in school remember that the Roman Empire collapsed into ruin, largely for one thing. It was no longer a nation of sturdy, independent farmers. It was a nation of city rats, living on the dole, give us bread and circuses, remember? And there was no longer the force of carriage to defend what they had. You remember Rome had been the one that conquered all the known world. Now they couldn't even defend their own self. And this was to prevent that. The law was this. As to city residential property, you could sell that. Now, you had the right to redeem it and buy it back within 1 year, but not after that. In other words, if you were just up against a temporary bad situation, you might have to sell your home to get through it. But when you got your money again, you could buy it back within a year. But your city home was not what made your living. So if you had to buy some other home in its place later, that was no great calamity. But the farms, that was the source of the living for yourself and your family. You could not sell nor mortgage your farm for a longer period than until the next Jubilee. Now, if last year was the Jubilee year, well, here was 49 years to go. You could sell it for that period. If next year was the Jubilee year, all you had you could sell was the rest of this year. Now remember, as the farmland, you could redeem it at any time that you got the money. Or your nearest relative, your next of kin, could redeem it for you if you didn't have the money and he had. Now, you got hard up. You mortgaged your farm and it was foreclosed. All right. At the time it was foreclosed, there were 20 years left to run until the next Jubilee year. Well, after 5 years, you raised the money to redeem it. Your creditor had had the profits of 5 years' use of the land after he foreclosed it, one-fourth of that 20 years. He'd already repaid himself out of that. So, when you came to redeem, you paid him for the remaining three quarters of the time that he might have held it under his foreclosure. In other words, if you redeemed, you redeemed in proportion to the unexpired time until the next Jubilee year. But at that Jubilee year, you came back to your farm and you didn't pay one penny, you took it over. Do you remember when the Depression hit, the last of the 20s and the early 30s, and the terrible situation we had in the farming states in the Midwest with the foreclosures and the farms there? You couldn't have had that kind of situation under God's law. Incidentally, our Liberty Bell, you know, got its name because cast in the metal around the rim of that bell was this quotation from Leviticus 25:10. It says that at the beginning of this Jubilee year, proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. What we should have been doing. I have mentioned another thing. God said, you know, that if we followed his law, we'd be the head, not the tail. One of his laws is that no alien can hold public office. You know, they're trying to make it a great virtue now that we can't discriminate against anybody because of race, religion, or national origin. In other words, one of these evil Jews can come in here from Russia and take over, and we have to give him all the rights of a born citizen, and we're violating God's law. Very plainly, Deuteronomy 17:15, one from among thy brethren shalt thou set over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. And that word stranger is the Hebrew word nokri, which means one of alien race. Not just somebody you haven't been formally introduced to, one of alien race. Remember among the punishments for disobeying God's law that was listed, the curses that would come upon us? It said, the stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high. He shall be the head and thou shalt be the tail. And now we're governed by this Russian Jew, Walkoff, as a curse because we violated God's law. Now we're pulling in our horns. We're running in shameful and abject terror from all the savages of the earth. And we're violating God's law again. Even our preachers, you know, like to preach in lofty indignation about the evils of colonialism. And they're ministers of Satan, not of God. They don't know their Bible. They couldn't utter these lies if they did. Isaiah 54, verses 2 and 3. Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitation. Spare not. Lengthen thy cords and strengthen thy stakes, for thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the nations. All right, Genesis 27, verses 28 and 29. Let people serve thee, and nations bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren, let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be everyone that curseth thee, and blessed be he that blesseth thee. Genesis 28, verse 14. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west and to the east, and to the north and to the south, and in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And our rule over them was a blessing, as we're seeing demonstrated now. Deuteronomy 4, verses 7 and 8. For what nation is there so great, who hath God so nigh unto them as Yahweh our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great, which hath statutes and judgments so righteous, is all this law which I set before you this day. It was our job to conquer and rule these savage people and bring this law there. Do you think these jungle savages have the intelligence or the education to follow these things because we go there and preach at them? Of course not. They have to be given a demonstration where they are compelled to obey it and get the results. Isaiah 43, verse 10 and 12. Ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, and my servant, whom I have chosen. Not the servant of these other races. God says, my servant. That ye may know and believe me, and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God born, neither shall there be after me. I, even I, am Yahweh, and beside me there is no faith. I have declared, and I have saved, and I have showed, when there was no strange God among them. Therefore ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, that I am God. And that was our job. When we did colonize, and I don't apologize for the word one bit, we brought to these savage nations the only civilization they knew. China was in peace. The warlords didn't rule it, and the communists didn't rule it. But we kept order there. Africa, we kept down cannibalism pretty well. You can't civilize a Negro any more than you can civilize a chimpanzee. But we kept them out of mischief. You know, the circuses have proved that you can teach either a chimpanzee or a Negro to ride a bike. But all the eons of time have not sufficed for the Negro to invent the wheel. No, you can't civilize them, but you can at least make them behave like tamed animals instead of wild. And we did it. And they were better off, you know. Well, if you don't already subscribe to U.S. News and World Report, you ought to. This week's number is especially good, dated July 1st. It tells how all these other nations who, we're told, look down their noses at us because we discriminate against Negroes here, and it tells the kind of discrimination they have in their own country, which usually consists in bloodshed and not merely a wanted separate eating place. They're going back to the jungle from which for a little time we took them. We withdrew the restraining influence we had there, which kept relative peace in the earth among these peoples. So as I said, all these are the laws of God, natural laws. We follow them as a matter of destiny, we reap the good. And if we disobey them, then as a matter of destiny, we pay the penalty. That's where the laws of God apply. That's where you could have the benefit of living in the real heaven on earth. And instead, we violated them and we live in a hell on earth. You can't outwit destiny.
You have been listening to a message by the late Pastor Bertrand L. Compre from his sermon titled, Trying to Outwit Destiny. If you would like a complete CD of this talk, ask for it by name and send a donation to cover our costs and help with radio time. Thank you.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.